This is the gratitude session 2017, talk 5. It's very lovely to be sharing the Dharma with so many beautiful and sincere people. Can you hear? Yeah, maybe not. The first talk had a poem that quoted a mystic named Lala Dead. I think I'm saying it right, Lala Dead. And this is a poem that she wrote. The soul, like the moon, is new and always new again. The soul, like the moon, is new and always new again. And I have seen the ocean continuously creating. And I have seen the ocean continuously creating. Since I scoured my mind and my body, I too, Lala, am new, each moment new. My teacher told me one thing, live in the soul. My teacher told me one thing, live in the soul. When that was so, I began to go naked and dance. Many of us here, if not all of us here, have a longing for awakening. We have an informed longing, an experienced-based calling to a largeness, to an unbinding, to a remembering. And we could put words to it, but the words aren't the longing. Words can be said about it, but those are like the voices that gently resonate a bell. They're not the full-bodied peal of the bell itself, but the bell resonates. You have a time, you have a longing for awakening in a time when a longing for awakening is mostly looked upon as a childish fantasy or a form of escape. If people catch wind of your devotion to spiritual practice, whether you're ordained or a layperson, you might hear from people that you're in a denial of the real world. The real world. And you ought to ask them, what is the real world? What makes that world real? If all 30 people in a choir singing with poor pitch doesn't change the pentatonic scale, a school of fish never having any knowledge that they move through water doesn't mean they're not wet. The longing for awakening, the aspiration for awakening, bodhicitta, is at first like shielding a small candle from the wind. It's fragile and it can be easily extinguished. And actually, we're shielding it from ourselves. We're shielding the small flame of faith from all the forms of diversion and doubt that diversion and doubt come forth in. It's instructive that the Buddha had Mara, the delusion principle, the tug and temptation of ego contraction, until the very night of final awakening. To the very night. And in some scriptures, Mara visits the Buddha again, even after he's been confirmed by the 10,000 things. So Mara sitting on the shoulder, awaiting any moment, the smallest gap to get a word in. The smallest gap to blow out your flame. Sesshin is a particular kind of practice that is not conceptual. It's not intellectual. But outside of this setting, the Dharma asks of us very careful reflection, very deep and honest thinking. It asks us to think carefully to look honestly at what a human life is for. It asks us to weigh the facts. It asks you to hold up a mirror. And looking into that mirror can be very difficult. Holding up that mirror, it can be a very, very heavy task. But in this, it's not necessary for you to be convinced by anyone else. My role is not to convince you. The Buddha's role is not to convince you. The Sangha's role is not to convince you. You prove the value. You prove the weight of the Dharma to yourself through your careful reflection on the facts. Facts of life. How many people really got the facts of life when they got the talk? You got a few facts. You prove the value of the Dharma, seeing what is seen with these very eyes through your own direct experience. Now, direct experience is not the reflective, always distanced, discursive reflection on experience. Because the first Nen is beyond reflection. And after the fact of your life, you reflect. You judge, you categorize, you opinion, you label. But that's not the fact. It's not the intimate fact. But of course, discursive reflections on our experience have their place. We prove the Dharma. We prove the value of investing in the path through our own direct experience. The direct experience of our own life, this moment, not divided between inside and outside or in between. But this life, this undivided life, is the ground of proving the Dharma. We have the precious mirror samadhi. And if you didn't hear yet, now you have it. Preserve it well. A wonderful line, its use removes all suffering. Its use removes all suffering. Well, there's something to, very straightforward teaching to prove against your own experience. The exactness of this before a flicker of thought. The exactness of this before you separate into me and not me and what I don't like about what is not me. And you can and you will taste that pure, clean freedom. You can and you will and you have tasted that pure, clean, simple freedom. And if only a flash. But the thing is, you can never forget that taste. You can never forget that taste, and so you remain hungry. And you become more hungry, and gradually, or for some with great urgency, you begin to put fuel on the flame. You take it from a candle, trade in your votive for a campfire. And because our life is not divided between inside, outside, and in between, the whole mess is kindling. All our disappointments, they reveal something. All our joys, there's something in them that causes the fire to blaze up. The friction of our relationships, both the kind of friction we really like in our relationships and the kind of friction we like to avoid. The burn of afflictive emotions, the sparks of insights, all the learning and all the forgetting, and all the turning back again after again to the real source of light, it's all put on the fire. And you graduate from the candle. and we sustain and we invigorate this longing, this lamp. And maybe for the great teachers, it was just a blaze. We look at what they consumed, who they consumed, a blaze of aspiration of awakening. We sustain and invigorate this not because the night will ever be totally outshone. The Dharma is not a path of taking samsara and having it not be samsara. Samsara is samsara. Not that the darkness should be eradicated, could be eradicated, but because that's what you do when it's hard to see which direction to walk. You flip a switch. You light a lamp. You can't cook your life without light to see by. You can't cook your life. You can't take a stack of ingredients. You can't see the faces hiding in the room. Being spiritual aces or saints, being some ideal, having a prescribed experience is not what this practice asks us. Not my lineage. We are asked to be wholehearted. We're asked to use all the ingredients here and now and here and now to wake up, to appreciate, to see within and see through, to feel within and feel through. And the thing is, this is its own reward. This wholeheartedness is its own fulfillment. This wholehearted feasting on your own life is the time of being freed of reward. It's the way of being freed of fulfillment. So there are three treasures, and the chant says that we are in the midst of them, even now. Maybe they're rusty. Three treasures, or slightly covered with mud, three treasures, but nevertheless, we are in the midst of the three treasures, and even now they are mirroring our understanding. We have the treasure of Buddha, awakened awareness. The depth of you is not broken. This practice of ours is so full of good news, there's not enough books to put it in. The depth of you is not broken. Even the shallow of you is not broken. Inner and outer are spacious, integrated, and calm. Yuan Wu, the compiler of the Blue Cliff Record, Engo Kokugon, he was a Rinzai lineage adept. He said this, "Fundamentally, this great light is there with each and every person right where they stand, empty, clear, all the way through, spiritually aware and pervasive. It is called the scenery of the fundamental ground. Sentient beings and Buddhas are both inherently equipped with it. It is perfectly fluid and boundless, fusing everything within it. It is within your own heart and is the basis of your physical body and of the five clusters of form, sensation, conception, and consciousness." We normally, in this culture, think the mind is produced by the meat computer. But Yuan Wu is saying something very different. This body arises out of this. It's an expression of this truth. It has never been defiled or stained, and its fundamental nature is still and silent. I have utter confidence. confidence that that is something you can verify. Its fundamental nature is still and silent. That which is using your eyes, using your ears, sourcing this body right now. False thoughts suddenly arise and cover it off and block it off and confine it within the six sense faculties and sense objects. Sense faculties and sense objects are paired off, and you get stuck and begin clinging and getting attached. You grasp at all the various objects and scenes and produce all sorts of false thoughts and sink down into the toils of birth and death, unable to gain liberation. And now he's speaking directly to us. The most important thing is for people of great faculties and sharp faith to turn the light of mind around and shine back. That's what Dogen Zenji said. Turn the light around and shine within. Ekko Hensho. Turn the light of mind around and shine back and clearly awaken to this mind before a single thought is born. So the treasure of Dharma. We, in our Fusatsu ceremony, say the Dharma are teachings that lead to freedom and ease. Teachings that lead to freedom and ease. In my mind, Dharma is whatever creative means. I don't care if they're Buddhist. Whatever creative means can help us not continuously light up our karmic confusion circuits. You could view the habitual clicking into your patterning like that. A certain circuit, a neuro circuit, gets lit up. The fight or flight gets lit up. The judge others in order to defend my heart gets lit up. The feed me, love me, comfort me because I'm uncomfortable gets lit up. It's just the karmic confusion circuits. It may be that we will never in this lifetime be free of the potential for these to be activated. Always we will live with that potential to have that button pushed and that state of mind come forward. It may be bone deep or DNA deep. Hakuin Zenji said it wasn't till the end of his life, and this was a ferocious practitioner, that his body fully accorded with his understanding of the Dharma. This is a person who had, there's a story of Hakuin Zenji when he was already a teacher. He sat face to face with a fellow monk. They were going to sit all night, all day for a week, and they both had an awl in their hand. And if the other person fell asleep or flinched, he would reach over and stab him. That's how wonderfully passionate these people were. You're going to put things in perspective. And so we're discovering maybe it all comes on at once. It happens for some people. Or maybe bit by bit, but we're discovering Buddha, how to light up that circuit. You put more and more voltage into that until all the circuits are integrated. And this all becomes so much talk. The third treasure, Sangha. We say this every morning, entrusting ourselves to the Sangha. And some of you look around like, what the? Entrusting ourselves to the Sangha, that's a transcendent statement. Entrusting ourselves to the Sangha. So on one side, we have the teaching, the investigation, and the realization that life is only relationship. only relationship. And all the metaphors are so crude. But if you have an octagon and you take away one angle, you no longer have an octagon. If you take away eyes, then the visual world is not. You take away ears, music, sound, speech is not. You take away mind, there's no body. You take away body, there's no mind. If I was a Sufi, I'd say, we are in the midst of mystical intercourse. Everything entering and being entered by everything else. Like it or not, your sounding the bell is the ringing of my mind, of my body, of all bodies. Your giving voice is the voicing of my mind, is the minding of my body, of all bodies. It's all just, it's so entangled you could blush. But because this lovemaking is always without intermission, we get bored and seek new lovers. Because this lovemaking is always without intermission, there is no such thing as relationship. That's the other side that we have to verify. There is no such thing as relationship. This is a good koan if you're a misty, mushy type. Have you heard that and got reactive? No, joking us. There is no such thing as relationship. You have never made contact with a single person. It's perfect intimacy. It could be called a tragedy in our ancestors in Dharma had a lot to say about this. Called it a person making a living in a ghost cave. It could be called a tragedy to endeavor in spiritual practice, fixating on, protecting, hoarding, grasping at some internal quiet spiritual thing. Some internal quiet spiritual thing. Aloof and remote, untouching and untouched. And the Buddha saw this, so he said, no self. It was his way of saying, cut it out. It's not the way it is. That's not what you are. We're not trying to find some internal, quiet, spiritual things. Living beings do not have Buddha nature, despite what you might have heard. David White expounds on the non-realization of Sangha. This poem is called, What Is It Like? What is it like? What is it like to be alone? What is it like to be alone? To fall into the abyss when voices do not speak. To fall into the abyss when voices do not speak. What is it like to have given everything away? What is it like to have given everything away in the wrong way, to have given everything away in the wrong way. What is it like to love no one? What is it like to love no one? What is it like to live in a house shared only by servants? Do you recognize that state of mind, that empty poverty? What is it like to live in a house shared only by servants? What is it like? It is like this. You are alone beneath a cold moon. You cannot speak. You are alone beneath a cold moon. You cannot speak. The bitter night has pierced your clothes, and when you sleep, your body stirs with a chill wind, which hour after hour and against your will refuses to stop. What is it like? Your body stirs with a chill wind, which hour after hour and against your will refuses to stop. In the cold morning, you will be open to one comfort only. In the cold morning, you will be open to one comfort only, the barely conceived surprise of being shaken awake. The barely conceived surprise of being shaken awake. Whether we've been at this for a little while or we're just starting, we're dealing with faith. We're dealing with faith. Our endeavor in this way has consequences beyond what the symbol and concept working mind can conceive. And thank goodness there is reality. Thank goodness there is wholenesses. Thank goodness there are stations of being, modes of experience that are outside the intellect's little net, that boring little net of words and concepts that can only ever refer to other words and concepts, and I never quite get to the middle. So my deepest hope is that myself and yourself contract Vimalakirti's sickness. I hope your cold passes and your mucus is relieved, but I hope you get Vimalakirti's sickness. I hope that we get a taste of the taste of a bodhisattva's mind. I grew up in Las Vegas, and I had never eaten a real vegetable. And this practice is like once you have eaten tomatoes fresh from the garden, ripe from the vine, after that, eating canned vegetables just does not hit the spot for you. The taste of canned vegetables is put in their proper perspective. And you'd rather not serve them to anyone else either. And so you cultivate. Take whatever little patch of earth you have and you plant a garden to nourish self, to nourish others. And what happens when the conditions are right is that even though you were plotting to make pizza sauce and, I don't know, what else do you do with tomatoes? Soup and put them in salad and you're worried about your harvest. You have more than you can possibly eat. You have a basket that's overflowing. The Buddha saw four sights when sneaking out of the palace. You probably all know this story. The first three sights were old age, sickness, and death. And that was a wake-up call to really see that for a sheltered person. The fourth sight was a person of devoted spiritual practice. Now, seeing the first three left Buddha with despair and anguish, in a way a confirmation of the hedonistic, narcissistic impulse, the justification for abandonment and revelry. But seeing the meditator, seeing something in this person, something that they embodied, some fragrance, some brightness, something that they carried that was different, some way with which they walked through the marketplace that was different than the way other people were walking through the marketplace. That fourth sight changed the world. That fourth sight changed your world. And it keeps on changing worlds, that fourth sight. the most underestimated offering in this world is one's state of mind. The most underestimated offering in this world is one's state of mind. But once we know how we really be, and we be that, we reclaim our deepest influence. We reclaim our deepest influence. And that can only flow out in its own way, in its own time. There was a guy named Jon Kabat-Zinn, who was a university student sometime in the 60s or 70s. And one day, some strange Jewish guy wearing Japanese robes named Philip Kaplow showed up in the commons to teach something called Zen meditation. And the world has changed. Who knew? Who knows? But somehow, something makes the spark. And this is not limited to Buddhism. God, let it not be limited to Buddhism. It's not limited to speech, and it's not confined in silence. It's larger than meditation. It's larger than saving or not saving beings. It's not dependent on us. And yet it's completely dependent on us. Don't excuse yourself from the web of responsibility. Yes, the Dharma wheel will keep on turning, but it's completely dependent on us for that to be real. So please, be a lamp. Please be a lamp. Even if you view yourself as a tiny flickering votive, please be a lamp. We know that the winter is long and cold and rainy, and everybody can use a friend in the way. This is crystal clear.